This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. The Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, held a personal appearance campaign with Trumpet subscribers in the Portland, Oregon area this past weekend. Later in today's show, we're going to talk with his personal assistant, Grant Turgeon, about how that went and what Mr. Fleury talked about. We're going to hear some stories about the folks who attended, so stick around for that. We'll also have a segment about something many people recognize today. There are a lot of dangers rising in the world, dangers that are in fact threatening Western civilization. And some people say an important answer to those dangers lies in Europe. Europe is viewed as a model of modern enlightened thinking, Western values like freedom, the rule of law, and democracy. And to preserve these things, we need more Europe, a stronger Europe, a unified Europe. We're going to have a conversation with Trumpet writer Richard Palmer about this. We'll talk about why we need to view these efforts in context with European history, and not just the good parts, but also the ugly parts. We'll put it in the context with what the Bible prophesies about Europe's future. At the end of the show, I'll say a few words about why it's important that you prove your belief in God and prove whether or not the Bible is the inspired word of God. We'll start the program today, though, by looking at the radicalization of the Democratic Party in America. It's a remarkable development. It's happened very fast. We've seen it in the response to the Mueller investigation's findings revealed in just the last few days, just how impervious to facts this segment of American society has become. It's worth looking into the roots of why this is happening, as we will now hear in this report from Andrew Miller.
Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez might be the most famous person in Congress. In a March 15th Gallup poll, 7 in 10 people had heard of the 29-year-old, who is the youngest member of Congress in history. That is remarkable name recognition for a representative who was waiting tables barely a year ago. Despite her lack of political experience, Ocasio-Cortez repeatedly makes headlines calling for open borders, free health care, free college, a federal jobs guarantee, a 70% tax rate for incomes above $10 million, and a Green New Deal that eliminates fossil fuel-powered electricity and requires retrofitting all existing U.S. buildings. Such radical proposals by someone who admits she is a socialist would have rendered a candidate unelectable just a few years ago. But Ocasio-Cortez won a landslide victory against Democratic incumbent Joe Crowley, a powerful 10-term congressman who many said would become the next Speaker of the House. But Ocasio-Cortez did not defeat Crowley alone. She was recruited and supported by a political organization working to hijack the Democratic Party. In 2016, a group called the Justice Democrats held auditions for candidates willing to run on their far-left platform. It received over 10,000 nominations. Ocasio-Cortez's brother submitted her name for the position while she was working at Flats Fix, a taco restaurant in Manhattan. The Justice Democrats selected 79 candidates to run against moderate Democratic incumbents. 7 won seats in the House of Representatives. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ayanna Pressley, Ilhan Omar, Pramila Jayapal, Rashida Tlaib, Raul Grijalva, and Ro Khanna. It is not necessarily unusual for political action committees to recruit candidates, though they don't normally look at the taco waitress crowd. But what makes the Justice Democrats unusual is that it has partnered with another political action committee, Our Revolution, the largest Marxist front in America. The goal is to transform the Democratic Party from within. The Justice Democrats and Our Revolution were formed out of the Bernie Sanders 2016 presidential campaign. Claiming more than 100,000 members in 50 states, these groups act as a front for the three most influential Marxist organizations in America: the Democratic Socialist of America, the Communist Party USA, and the Freedom Road Socialist Organization. our revolution is primarily recruiting far-left candidates to run as Democrats in state and local elections, while the Justice Democrats are recruiting potential far-left candidates for federal office. Most of our revolution leadership comes from the Democratic Socialist of America, but some are members of the Freedom Road Socialist Organization or the Communist Party USA. This participation is part of a strategy to hijack the Democratic Party. Communist Party leader John Bachtel explained this strategy in an online webinar on May 23, 2018, when he told an audience of activists from the Democratic Socialist, Freedom Road, and Communist Party USA that they must campaign for openly socialist candidates within the Democratic Party. Combined, the Democratic Socialists of America, Freedom Road Socialist, and Communist Party USA have about 67,000 members. Most of them are not the type of people who could be elected to office, but by using groups like the Justice Democrats and Our Revolution, these 67,000 activists can recruit more charismatic personalities like Ocasio-Cortez to espouse ideals on their behalf. Investigative journalist Trevor Loudon wrote for the Epoch Times, "Our Revolution is a networking tool for the DSA, CPUSA, FRSO Alliance. It's a vehicle to either transform the Democratic Party into a completely socialist organization or to form the nucleus of a new Marxist third party." As a result of the work done by the Justice Democrats and Our Revolution, the Congressional Progressive Caucus increased its membership from 78 to 96 members last election. That means the radical left now controls 22% of the House of Representatives and 41% of the entire Democratic caucus. This dramatic political transformation did not happen overnight. Decades before Ocasio-Cortez was recruited, Plain Truth Editor-in-Chief Herbert W. Armstrong warned that communism would strip America of its blessings, the greatest blessings ever conferred on any people, not because socialists outmaneuvered conservatives, but because the American people as a whole have turned away from God's law. In particular, he warned that communist thought would pervert America's morals, sabotage its education system, wreck its social structure, destroy its spiritual life, and weaken its economic power. Mr. Armstrong asked in his March 1969 Plain Truth Personal, "Why are our people unable to recognize the communist line, the communist plan and conspiracy, in colleges, in university riots, in propaganda accusing police brutality, in Black Power, Black Panther, and other slogans, even in civil disobedience and nonviolent movements of protest which lead to violence?" He answered with this shocking truth: "The guiding hand in student revolt is the Communist Party. Many students, their emotions stirred and enraged to violence, do not themselves realize this. Yet actually, these young leaders of the New Left movement are going beyond the Communist Party. Their plan is to stir up college-age students to revolt first, and the teenage high school adolescents. If they can corrupt and or win over tomorrow's students, they will gain control." Now, Mr. Armstrong based this forecast primarily on Bible prophecy. He directed his readers to Scripture, which says that end-time Israel would become mixed up ideologically with foreigners. In particular, he pointed to Hosea 7, verses 8 through 13, which warns that Israel would seek alliances with foreign nations, forsaking God, foreign alliances that would eat away Israel's strength unknown to him. He explained that the modern descendants of ancient Israel primarily settled in the United States and Britain, and that they were indeed forsaking God and turning to foreign-sponsored false ideologies like communism. Today, the 1960s New Left radicals that Mr. Armstrong wrote about are the leaders of the modern Democratic Party and its affiliated political action committees. These radical leaders are now shifting their party even further to the left to gain the support of the millennial generation, a demographic that leans overwhelmingly Democrat and even socialist. Such a strategy can only lead to civil unrest and economic collapse.
Thank you very much for that. That is fascinating material there, Andrew. You know, watching this play out is so fascinating because, you know, in some ways you've dug into the roots. What are these organizations that are sponsoring candidates like the seven that you mentioned, including Ocasio-Cortez? And there's obviously a lot there that is alarming. But in one sense, you don't need to dig. If you just look at the policies that they are espousing and promoting, there's enough to be concerned about just in that, that there should, and I think there are a lot of Americans who are just kind of horrified by what's happening. And I would imagine even within the Democratic Party, there would be quite a few people who are looking at what these new freshman representatives are promoting and say, this is not the Democratic Party that I have been a part of.
Right. So many of these platforms, you're talking about like abolishing the United States Immigration Service. You're talking about open borders. You're talking about a federally guaranteed job for anyone who wants one, a $15 minimum wage, all these policies that two or three decades ago you could not find outside of the Communist Party USA. And if you, like I said, if you do some digging, you can actually find that those policies were hatched in the Communist Party USA and then transferred into the Democratic Party like an incubator to go national with it. Well, like I said, even if you don't believe any of that or think that sounds like a conspiracy theory, yeah, just the policies, speak for themselves,
right,
as to the damage they'll do to the nation. And there is definitely those even within the Democratic Party that are concerned.
Yeah, you can see a certain amount of that tension between, say, the old guard in the Democratic Party and these new folks.
Right. These are like I mentioned in the standalone segment at the beginning, that these are some of these policies that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez are saying are things that would have made you unelectable even one or two election cycles ago. Mm-hmm. And there are still those like the Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and some of the old guard that are a little uncomfortable with these new policies.
How are they getting away with this? You just wonder why are they not putting up more resistance?
Right. Well, now you do have there is, I think, personally some self-servingness in some of this. As I mentioned before, you've got these groups like Bernie Sanders almost took the nomination from Hillary Clinton last election. So, I mean, he's definitely got...
He's in the mix.
...a support base, and this Our Revolution, right, and this Justice Democrats are political organizations that came out of the Bernie Sanders campaign speaking to that movement. They've got a base, and they... I mentioned before that they do control about 41% of the Democratic Party.
Substantial.
So it's a substantial base that has to be reckoned with. Now, like I said, Nancy Pelosi, she was Speaker of the House before President Trump was elected at a time. I mean, I think it was, you have to go back a couple election cycles, but she was the Speaker of the House at one point.
Yeah.
And then lost that position due to a sweeping Republican victory in the 2016 election. The Democrats lost so many seats nationwide on all federal, local, and state levels that they were actually weaker than they'd been at any point since 1928. So almost 100 years ago, and now she's Speaker of the House again. So you do have to ask her, is like after presiding over this huge catastrophe for the Democratic Party, how on earth did you get your job back? And those who look into the Byzantine deal making quid pro quo going on in Washington have pretty much determined that she realized that if she's going to be Speaker of the House, she needs the support of this 41% of these radicals. And there's almost kind of like a deal like, well, yeah, we'll let you be Speaker of the House again, despite your not doing so hot last time, if you kind of give us a bit of a free leash. So I think personally, her and Chuck Schumer and some of these old guards are a little concerned about some of these radical proposals coming from Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her ilk. Maybe even concerned that if the party goes too far left, they're going to do very poorly in the 2020 elections.
That's the thing. It's just watching this play out, and it's interesting, I guess, kind of thinking about this overlaid with the news over these past few days about Donald Trump's vindication with the Mueller report, and just how many factors there are that seem to be breaking in Donald Trump's favor. When you look at how is this going to play out in presidential politics over the next couple of years, with the Democratic Party breaking as hard left as it is, and so many of the Democratic Party presidential candidates, they might play well to a segment of the Democratic voters and, you know, gin up a certain amount of support among the more radical demographic within the Democratic Party. But how is this going to play out in a national election? It's hard not to see this just really handing Donald Trump a whole lot of help.
Yeah, because the Democrats, they're giving the radicals a free hand because they do have millions of supporters nationwide. But also their support is very likely overestimated because they tend to be, people like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez tend to be more vocal than your average Trump voter. So she gets the headlines every day about open borders and free health care and free this or free that. But they actually, that same Gallup poll I cited at the beginning, how 7 in 10 of Americans have heard of her, have found out that, but also 70% of those who have heard of her don't like her very much.
Yeah, you know, so. Thinking about the last presidential election, I think we had the most polarized election in certainly decades, if not centuries, if not in all of American history, where you had essentially two people who had garnered so much antipathy on the part of such a huge portion of the American electorate that everybody was kind of going into the polling stations, holding their nose and pulling the lever for the candidate that they liked, that they hated the least.
You know? Right.
But it seems like we're setting ourselves up for one that's even worse. And this segment of the Democratic Party that has this kind of emotion ruling over everything. If we do have a repeat of 2016 in 2020 and Donald Trump manages to pull off a second term, you just wonder what sort of pandemonium is going to break loose in America under those conditions. At any rate, it's a fascinating subject, and we really do appreciate you looking into the details here. I'm sure there's going to be more to come as we just do some more digging into some of the individuals that are now in positions of power in America's capital. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller about an effort to take over the Democratic Party in the United States and to make it even more radical than it already is. He's written an article on thetrumpet.com about this. The title of it is How 67,000 Socialists Hijacked the Democratic Party. It also points to Gerald Fleury's reprint article, Communism in America Today, a really important subject for some perspective on what's happening in American politics. Thanks so much for your time, Andrew.
Hey, thanks for having me.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Europe is widely seen as a model of modern, enlightened thinking, Western values like freedom, the rule of law, and democracy. After all, Europe was the birthplace of the Enlightenment. In a world facing a lot of threats to Western civilization, the logical conclusion of a lot of people is that we need more Europe. Well, trumpet writer Richard Palmer has written an article for the upcoming print edition, May, June 2019 issue. This will hit the website this week, saying we might not be reading Europe and particularly Europe's history correctly. To talk about this, we have him via Skype from our office in England. Hello, Richard.
Good afternoon.
So there's obviously a lot about Europe's history to celebrate, going back to the time of the Roman Republic. America's founders were very high on the virtues of the Republic. But you say, you don't dispute that, but you say we just need to view that history in its larger context. Help us to do that.
Right. I think it's an interesting discussion to have, especially in some ways it's similar and more important to the same kind of discussions you're seeing in the news with, okay, well, you've got these statues of people that that owned slaves, but also did good things in the past as well. Mm-hmm. But yes, you look at the Roman Republic and you have, we tend to focus, say, on some of these figures that we admire or that the founding fathers admired, Cincinnatus, Cato, Cicero. But then you also take a full look at the Roman Republic, and there's a whole lot of pretty horrible things going on. Infanticide, probably one of the most horrible, where the custom was if a child was born, it would be taken to the head of the family, the father, the pater familias, and it wasn't counted as a person until he accepted it. And so you'll find husbands writing letters to their wives saying that if they're away when the time a baby is expected, and they'll say, well, if it's a boy, call it so and so, and if it's a girl, expose it. Mm. And what that means is, well, just leave the baby on a rubbish dump to die. And it's a society that's full of death, full of violence, where people watch gladiators for sport, a military state. And then you look at some of its activities, and really Rome's empire, the Roman Republic's reach was founded on two atrocities, where in the same year they wiped out Carthage, destroyed every man, woman, and child. They wiped out Corinth, the most prosperous city in the Mediterranean, demolished the city. It's an empire built on fear, violence, cruelty. And often we look at the good things, we look at the poets, we look at Latin, we look at some of the cultural achievements and just completely ignore that other side of it.
So you bring up an interesting point, the fact that, you know, we have talked quite a bit about just how dangerous it is for us to tear down history, erase history, to look at, say, the America as just a bunch of slave owners, and this has a terribly racist past and so on. And we need to focus on the positives, and we need to look at what we overcame. Obviously, when you had America's founders reading the history of the Roman Republic, they were focusing on the virtues that they were expounding, the political structures that they put in place, those aspects of that society that really were emulating, you know, that were worthy of emulation and that were laudable. What's the difference here in your view?
History is not a science, it's an art, and I think it's about understanding the character overall of the different areas that you're looking at. You look at any human being and you can find good things that they've done and you can find bad things that they've done. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, there's a huge difference between someone that's sitting on death row for some horrible crimes that's also happened to do some good things, and somebody who's about to be nominated to the Supreme Court that might have done a few bad things. There's a whole different scale there. Mm-hmm. And I think what tends to happen is we end up manipulating things because of our own domestic political agendas. And so if we don't happen to like the person who's submitting to the Supreme Court, we ignore all of the bad things and play up ignore all the good things and really play up on the bad things and make them sound as terrible as possible. And if we think the person on death row should be let out, we focus on all of the good things and diminish the bad. Whereas there's no kind of understanding of the whole, of a value judgment of, well, what is the character of what we're looking at here? Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk more about the efforts to unify Europe politically today. There's obviously a lot of effort that's being put toward that economically and politically and even militarily. And leaders in Europe today are hearkening back to the history of efforts to unify Europe, and they're celebrating all the best aspects of that past. Put that history in context for us.
Right. So we've been talking a lot about this agreement where Macron and Merkel signing that deal at Aachen.
Mm-hmm.
Where everything's meant to link back to Charlemagne, and they're all talking about Charlemagne. And yes, they all talk about, say, Charlemagne's great cultural achievements and his effort to spread education and writing. And again, it's not like those things didn't happen. They're not making stuff up. But at the same time, it completely airbrushes some other things that should really be overwhelming when we look back at Charlemagne and when we understand the lessons for European unity today. Again, this is at its heart and at its character a vicious empire. Charlemagne was a warlord. There's no really disputing that. He came from a society where that's, if you were a king, if you're an emperor, that's what you did. Every summer you went off to war and you tried to capture as money, valuables, and even human beings to use to reward your followers as possible. And Charlemagne, even for a warlord of that period, was especially vicious and vindictive. Not just killing people in battle, but mass executions of prisoners. Tom Holland has some excellent material. I quoted from a few different books in this article. But he says, not since the age of the Caesars had atrocities been committed on so imperious a scale, and never before with the goal of imposing the love of Christ. So he went to try and bring order to Europe, and to say, well, he tried to bring unity to Europe, you're focusing on a tiny picture of the overall, some of the less important parts of the picture. The picture is he tried to bring unity to Europe through the sword and through hugely vindictive punishments for anyone who wouldn't accept his Catholic Christian religion.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an important point, that you can't really look at Europe's history without discussing the role of the Roman Catholic Church and those efforts to unify Europe. They were very involved in those. Talk about more about that more, and why that would be particularly relevant as we're looking at the European unification efforts today.
That's something else that comes up time and time again in the history. And I think if you look today, I think there are some that are maybe, if they could unify Europe without the Catholic Church, they'd be happy to do so, but they haven't been able to make that work. I think it's maybe a bit similar to Napoleon, who you look at his early career and he wasn't necessarily naturally the biggest fan or the person you'd think would make a natural ally of the Catholic Church, but he ends up signing a concordat with them, and after they were completely kicked out of France in the Revolution, bringing them right back in, giving them leadership opportunities, restoring them at really the heart of French society and education. And so you see that when Europe has been unified in the past and there have been efforts of European unity, it's only been able to happen alongside the Catholic Church, because you've just got, well, I think that I guess gets into a whole other pretty complicated subject, but they've got 2,000 years of Catholic heritage there, and it's hard to replicate or find anything to unify the different fractured nations of Europe without that. I think it was, to paraphrase Napoleon, he said, I see in religion the mystery of the social order. It's a way of getting people to accept something they otherwise would not.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other chapters of European history that you feel like are relevant to this discussion in terms of just helping us to understand these efforts that we see today really are part of a long history, there's a long pedigree of these types of efforts, and it does require understanding that history in order to have the proper, I guess, caution about these efforts today.
Yeah, I mean, there are quite a few. You see this pattern. I mean, rather than going into too much detail, you see this with Otto the Great after Charlemagne. It's the same character, the same kind of cruelty, the same use of the Catholic Church. The Habsburg Empire is another very important one. And this, the Habsburg Empire, in some ways for me, is where this subject kind of grew out of, because Mr. Gerald Flury talks about exactly this subject towards the end in some of the final chapters of his book, Daniel and Locke's Revelation. And it was some of his comments based on Bible prophecy that got me really thinking along these lines. One of the quotes that I put in the article, he talked about how the Habsburgs did their killing while supporting artists like Mozart, Bach, and Schubert. They were very sophisticated as they slaughtered people. And he talked about how you can go and you can visit these castles within Austria, within the Habsburg Empire, all across Europe, really, where upstairs you would have the height of culture, the greatest artists, the greatest music of the world has produced at that point. And downstairs they'd be torturing people because of their religion. And we do, as he pointed in that booklet, tend to have this distorted view of history where we just look upstairs and we ignore the dungeon. And that's what European leaders are doing today when they talk about Charlemagne and building this European. They focus on the upstairs. They don't mention the dungeon that was the only way that they were able to accomplish this united Europe.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad you bring in the prophetic angle of it. Gerald Fleury is obviously looking at the prophecies of the Bible as a means of understanding what truly is happening here in Europe's history and in its present and what is about to happen. Maybe you can just put that in that prophetic context for us.
So at the start, we talked about how this is about understanding the character of Europe as a history or its personality. And the Bible describes that in a very specific way. This European empire, I guess I should say, rather than Europe as a whole. But the Bible describes that very specifically. And it matches exactly what the picture that we get if we take a sober look at Europe's history. Daniel 7 and verse 7, I'll just read a more modern translation. It talks about Europe being symbolized as a beast that is terrifying, dreadful, and very strong. It devoured and crushed its victims with huge iron teeth and trampled their remains beneath its feet, which is a perfect description of all of these different periods of history that we talked about, of Rome that defeated Carthage in a war and then 50 years later comes back and systematically, brick by brick, house by house, kills everyone and demolishes the whole city. And Mr. Fleury, he talks about, he says, these are dreadful beasts that conquer and enslave entire nations. That's what these beasts do. But instead, we like to think of them as harmless wild animals, he wrote, that our nations, our people, we fear to face the extremely unpleasant truth. He writes that the Roman Empire is the most vicious beast this world has ever known. It is the greatest monster human beings have ever seen. And the Bible contains a lot of warnings about what's coming in the future, that we've got one more resurrection of this beast. But if we blind ourselves to its history, if we focus only on the good side, we don't have a good picture of the character of this beast. And so it's so easy then to just be asleep, to, well, okay, yeah, you know what? If Europe got a bit of a backbone, if the Catholic Church was more involved, well, they'd stand up against Islam. They'd be a great ally for the United States. That's a good thing in the world. It's so easy to get that perspective. But if you start to look at Europe's true nature that you get from a sober look of history and that the Bible gives very clearly through these passages of scripture, then it sounds a very powerful warning for the future. But then the other reason why these passages and that what Mr. Fleury draws out from these passages is so important is that same chapter, Daniel 7, that talks about this beast and that paints this very bleak picture of this beast, spends quite a lot of time as well explaining what comes after it, explaining why we have this beast power, explaining that it's going to be resurrected one more time, and then that's it. It's leading the way to Jesus Christ returning. It's leading the way to this completely new civilization with a completely new character. And even as you study that, you can see why God allows a beast power like that. And so, you know, it's important to see what's coming next, but it's important so that when that has come and that we're faced with this really bleak beast power that's on the scene, we know that there's hope still for what comes after and hope for the future.
Well, that's outstanding. We will definitely put a link to that booklet of Gerald Fleury's Daniel Unlocks Revelation in the show notes for the program today. You can also read Herbert W. Armstrong's booklet, Who or What is the Prophetic Beast? And it goes through those prophecies, really chapter and verse, explaining God's view on this European history. Richard also wrote, or he helped to write a book called The Holy Roman Empire in Prophecy that goes through each of the resurrections of this unified European empire that had the blessing and really the control of the Catholic Church. It's very important history to look at in context. We've been talking to trumpet writer Richard Palmer about the history and prophecy of Europe. He's written an article for the May-June 2019 print edition of The Trumpet. This is posting today at thetrumpet.com. The title of the article, European Unity, Be Careful What You Wish For. Thank you very much, Richard.
Thanks for having me.
This This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry held a personal appearance campaign with Trumpet subscribers in the Portland, Oregon area this past Sunday and Monday, as we will now hear in this report from Grant Turgeon.
On March 24th and 25th, Philadelphia Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry spoke to approximately 210 and 150 subscribers. Mr. Flurry's lecture on Sunday afternoon was about the fruits of God's government. He discussed the recent United States college admissions scandal in which rich parents bribed universities to accept their children. He exposed the lawless spirit in America that has caused generations of America's leaders to be educated in far-left indoctrination centers, where credentials are prioritized over merit, presence over performance, and social influence over skills. Mr. Flurry then contrasted the lawlessness in America with the reverence for law in God's church. He said afterward that he gained more depth of understanding about Hebrews chapter 9 earlier that day. This chapter discusses the three items inside the Ark of the Covenant in ancient Israel: the Ten Commandments, Aaron's rod, and manna. Mr. Flurry focused on a phrase in Hebrews 9 verse 4, "Aaron's rod that budded." In ancient Israel, God resolved a dispute between a group of rebellious princes and Moses and Aaron by causing Aaron's rod to blossom and bud with almonds. This miracle made clear that God was using Moses and his spokesman Aaron, and not the princes. Mr. Flurry showed how God has always worked through one man, in ancient Israel and Judah, and in all seven eras of the one true Church of God. He quoted Mr. Armstrong, who famously and repeatedly said, "Government is everything," and emphasized that the true head of the church, even above God's man, is Jesus Christ. On the plane ride back to Oklahoma City early Tuesday morning, Mr. Flurry said he chose to speak about the subject of God's government because it is often maligned by critics. Rather than highlighting the corrective aspects of government, he expounded on the beautiful rewards of God's government: a loving, merciful government that shepherds God's loyal people toward eternal life, marriage to Christ, and headquarters rule alongside him over the earth and the universe. Mr. Flurry concluded his first lecture by enumerating five fruits of God's government. Fruit number one, a prophetic message. No man can shut God's open door for the warning message. Fruit number two, godly family. Little children are created in the likeness of God and have the opportunity, especially if raised God's way, to be born spiritually as children of God. Fruit number three, more understanding than teachers in the world. Mr. Flurry joked that everyone in attendance already has received a better education and more wisdom than members of the United States Congress. Fruit number four, revelation to the church. The literature tab at thetrumpet.com is populated with hundreds of books, booklets, and reprint articles full of revelation delivered to the church by God through Mr. Armstrong and then through Mr. Flurry. Fruit number five, you have the head. Mr. Flurry read Colossians 2 verse 19 and urged listeners to cling to Christ and never let a man tear them away from God's government. On Monday night, Mr. Flurry delivered a modified version of the Book of Hebrews Part 2, which he has spoken about at most of his other eight personal appearance campaigns since 2017. Like in the first lecture, he drew attention to Hebrews chapter 9. He challenged listeners to focus on the sacrifice of Jesus Christ, which paid the death penalty for the sins of all mankind, and to trust that God will fulfill every one of his promises. He explained the need for loving correction from God to strengthen us in areas where we are weak, which prepares us to teach and rule successfully, unlike the angels and the vast majority of mankind. For the March 24th event, 67 of the 210 subscribers were non-members. On March 25th, 27 of 150 were non-members. 144 subscribers attended both lectures. So far, five non-members have signed up to attend a follow-up Bible study by Western United States Regional Director Brian Davis on March 31st. Mr. Flurry, who served for a decade as a Worldwide Church of God minister in the Tri-Cities area of nearby southeastern Washington State, has a long history with the state of Oregon. In November 2001, he approved the purchase of 11 cedars of Lebanon, which had been growing in a field in Oregon since, it was estimated, 1986, the same year Mr. Armstrong died. Three of the cedars were planted in front of the John Amos Fieldhouse. In April 2002, he toured the sites that Mr. Armstrong frequented in the 1920s and 1930s and later wrote about in his autobiography. On the tour, the late PCG minister David Todd and Oregon member James Lowry took him to the Fisher Farm, where they found Mr. Armstrong's prayer rock. Mr. Fleury acquired the prayer rock later that year. It is now on display at the Hall of Administration on the headquarters campus. When Mr. Todd died a few years later, Mr. Fleury traveled to Oregon to introduce the new regional director. Around that same time, Mr. Fleury also hosted a personal appearance campaign in Portland. In September 2017, he celebrated the Feast of Trumpets with the Portland congregation. Mr. Fleury's predecessor, the late theologian and educator Herbert W. Armstrong, established the work of God in the Philadelphia era in Oregon. He moved to Oregon with his family in July of 1924. It was in Oregon that Mr. Armstrong studied day and night for 6 months at the Portland Public Library to prove the Sabbath doctrine and disprove the theory of evolution. It was in Oregon that God humbled him, brought him to complete and total repentance, and gave him renewed purpose. It was in Oregon that he was tested with years of poverty and keeping the holy days without understanding their meaning. It was in Oregon that he learned how to get real results to prayer. It was in Oregon that he was baptized and ordained a minister. It was in Oregon that he experienced mic fright while broadcasting on a tiny radio station for the first time. It was in Oregon that he produced the first copies of the Plain Truth magazine. And it was in Oregon that he started hosting evangelistic campaigns, the forerunner to the personal appearance campaigns held by Mr. Fleury today.
All right. Thank you very much for that, Grant. It's good to get a bit of an overview there. I appreciated you just telling us about the substance of those messages that Mr. Fleury gave. We're actually working on writing up some of this material from the personal appearance campaigns that he's been giving. You mentioned he's been talking a lot about Hebrews. He wrote about Hebrews in 2016 in the Royal Vision, and he's accumulated quite a lot of material since then that we're hoping to put together in a booklet on that subject here within the next few months. So it's exciting. He's continuing to expand on that material. That's good to hear.
Definitely. And he's always talking about how he wants to tweak the messages to be specific to each area where he travels. And especially if he thinks that anyone in the area might have already heard some of it before. So he's always trying to make it unique every time, even if it's the same general subject. For example, when he was in Portland a year and a half ago for Trumpets, he spoke to them, and so he didn't want to necessarily speak too much about that topic. He knew that most of the Philadelphia Church of God has already heard Hebrews 1 through 5, so he specifically decided to do the second part with that group.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the church has such a long history in that area. It's interesting. That's where I was when I came into the PCG, and whenever I have the opportunity to travel up there, so many of the members who are in the church up there, these are long-time pillars. They've been around for decades and just been staunch supporters of the church, and it's just very encouraging to see to see them up there. Maybe you could just give us a sense of just how this maybe differed from some of the other campaigns, or any stories that that unfolded while you were up there.
Well, for one thing, it definitely seemed like perhaps this was the most eager group of people, like people the most excited to speak with Mr. Fleury after each of his lectures. And it wasn't just Mr. Fleury. There were three other ministers there. Mr. Davis, I already mentioned, and then local ministers Robert Morley and Darren Verbout. Mr. Morley told me a pretty funny story the second night about this 90-year-old man who got up and basically ran to him as soon as the first lecture was over because he was so excited to speak with the minister. He said that even though he was 90, he was moving like he was 30 or 40, so quite quick of feet. And Mr. Fleury actually signed three of his books for an Oregon member who then teased him that he would be back with more books to sign once Mr. Fleury writes more books. So he was kind of joking, like, I can't wait till you write some more books because then I'm getting more autographs. So there's quite a few stories
like that. It's amazing
that
he's keeping up because Mr. Fleury's writing a lot.
Exactly. And that was one thing that he definitely pointed out, especially on the first night, just that they're, you know, he's written around 50 books and booklets. Mr. Armstrong wrote around that many as well. And that's just such an obvious proof of where God is working and where the revelation is coming, the one true church. So a lot of people brought their books, or they picked up a lot of literature from the back tables in the room. Really excited just to get into that and dig deep into that.
Yeah. Everything goes smooth with the plane?
It was actually perfect. We didn't even have a bump in the sky, so I could tell a lot of people were probably praying about that, because the last two trips were eventful, to say the least. So this time it went really smoothly. It was interesting because the pilots mentioned a couple times about Mr. Fleury praying, and Mr. Fleury never told them that he had been praying about these issues. So when they were trying to go from England to Jerusalem last month, they had an issue with the starter of the motor wouldn't really rev up like it was supposed to. And Mr. Fleury said later that he was praying really hard in there, but he didn't tell them that he was doing that. He was doing that silently. And then someone, I think it was Mr. Davis, asked one of the pilots recently, you know, what happened with the motor. And the pilot told him Mr. Fleury prayed. So it was like he already knew. And then when we were about to go home last night, the co-pilot said, we either need a new starter for the plane or we need you. So they both seem to acknowledge that prayer had a pretty big impact there.
You think about the effort that Mr. Fleury is making to get out there, and the numbers involved. You know, it's actually quite amazing considering how many people were there, how many of them were in the church already. Quite a substantial majority. But you think about every single one of those individuals who's hearing that message is special to God, is important to God. He's, you know, involved in trying to reach them in some pretty special ways. It must be kind of neat to just see the kind of interactions that they're having as they're attending, they're, you know, listening attentively to what Mr. Fleury is saying.
And Mr. Fleury was even talking about how it's really important for the members to have that too, especially being out in the field where they don't even know if they're going to see him every couple years. So the chance that they finally get to speak with him is pretty special to them. I mean, a couple of men flew in from Canada to go to it. Several others flew in from Northern California. Someone came all the way from Nevada. There was one prospective member who told Mr. Fleury that his twin teenage girls were really excited to go to Philadelphia Youth Camp this summer for the first time. There was a Mennonite couple who actually attended, and he was speaking to someone who was staffing the literature table at the back of the room. And it just so turned out that member was once a Mennonite too. So Mr. Morley was joking that God prepared the member his whole life just to speak
for
to that
moment.
Couple. So that was pretty special. And then someone, obviously with the church emphasis on archaeology, one of the Washington State members jokingly gifted Mr. Fleury with a red Make Archaeology Great Again hat. So we were all laughing pretty hard about that too.
Well, that's great. Well, we've been talking with Gerald Fleury's personal assistant, Grant Turgeon, about Mr. Fleury's recent campaign in Portland, Oregon. It's great to get the inside scoop there, Grant. Thanks for the update.
It's really fun to be on.
It's time for today's last word.
It is the most essential question in your life. Does God exist? Or is God a myth? Many people think of God as a superstition or a human invention. In a lot of ways, modern society is built on that assumption. Millions of people believe what they believe because they carelessly take it for granted. And meanwhile, millions of others take it for granted that God does exist. Why is that? Because they were taught it from childhood, or because the people around them generally believe it. But few of them have proved it. The answer to this essential question isn't something to take for granted. Wrong assumptions lead to dangerous error for individuals and for entire societies. Many societies have invented gods from their own imaginations. Many have worshipped them using idols of wood or stone or metal. Many have idolized the sun or other inanimate objects of nature. These gods have proven false. Some societies have used belief in their gods to justify terrible abuse of fellow human beings, including religious crusades and mass murder. At the same time, societies that have rejected God's existence have perpetrated some of the worst mass killings in human history. Throughout human history, wrong answers to this essential question have caused mountains of tragic human suffering. If God does exist, who or what is God? The answer is crucial to your understanding of your own purpose for existence and of how you must live your life. To begin proving the answer, I want to encourage you to read Does God Exist? By Herbert W. Armstrong. You can find it online at thetrumpet.com in our literature library. You can even request a free copy. We'd be happy to send you one. The question of God's existence leads to many other vital questions. What is God's nature and character? Did God create the material world? And if he did, why? What is God's purpose? All of these questions and many more are answered in the first chapter of Mr. Armstrong's most important book, Mystery of the Ages. The title of that chapter is Who and What is God? It's an excellent resource for further study on this subject. The second essential question you have to answer is the Bible true? It's by far the most popular and influential book in human history, but is it actually what it claims to be, the authoritative word of the Creator God? Or is it just the religious writings of a small ancient race groping in the darkness of human ignorance and of superstition, trying to develop a concept of God? Again, we have to acknowledge that most people operate according to their own assumptions or received understanding rather than having proved the answer. Modern education instills within students a hostility toward the Bible. And most students accept those ideas and attitudes. They suppose them to be rational and irrefutable without examining evidence to the contrary. And those students have gone on to shape the society and the world in which we live. At the same time, most people who accept the idea that the Bible is inspired by God don't study it, or they don't believe it and live by it. The Bible makes this extraordinary claim in 2 Timothy 3:16. All scripture is given by inspiration of God and is profitable for doctrine, for reproof, for correction, for instruction in righteousness. That's quite a claim, but the Bible can be hard to understand. Many people pick and choose the portions that they find inspirational and ignore the rest. Many twist the meaning of certain scriptures and dismiss anything they disagree with. You don't need to wonder about this crucial subject. You can prove whether the Bible is, in fact, the inspired, authoritative Word of God. Believe it or not, the Bible itself offers several tests of its own authority. It makes claims that can be shown absolutely to be true or false. You can study these yourself by reading Mr. Armstrong's booklet, The Proof of the Bible. You can read it online or ask us for a copy. We'll send you one. Proving the Bible is a life-changing study. You will see definitively that God does exist, that he's provided detailed revelation regarding who he is, what his plan and purpose are, why he created mankind, and how to live in a way that leads to fulfillment, satisfaction, peace, prosperity, and happiness. Now is the time to begin your study of this life-changing question. I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. Thanks to my guests, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Grant Turgeon. And I'll leave you with this thought from Joseph Addison: reading is to the mind what exercise is to the body. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.